Coming up on This Week in Google, we've got Kevin Marks, Ron Richards, and myself, Jason Howell. We're going to talk all about some Pixel rumors that are around the corner, a little bit about the Essential phone. We've got Boston Dynamics robots. They're making a move to SoftBank. We've got Facebook and Safety Check. A whole lot to talk about coming up next on This Week in Google.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly, CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 409 for Wednesday, June 14th, 2017. Practical telepathy. This episode of This Week in Google is brought to you by Capterra. Capterra helps you find and compare software solutions for your business needs with over 400 software categories, from accounting to workflow management. Visit capterra.com/twig to start your free search today. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/twig. It's time for Twig, This Week in Google. Week two, I think, of two of Leo Laporte being out of the studio. So I'm in his place. Jason Howell, I'm super psyched to be back. I have not one, but two amazing guests, because both Jeff and Stacey are actually out this week. We had to get two amazing guests to fill their shoes. First up, my longtime friend, Ron Richards, all about Android and so many other things, including a Twin Peaks podcast, by the way.
Yes, my many, many podcasts. It's great to be back. I believe last time I was on This Week in Google, it was the same lineup, I think.
I know. Yes, it was very close to this. Yes. I think it was right around Pixel time or hardware time. Also joining us, Kevin Marks, kevinmarks.com. How's it going, Kevin?
It's going great. It's not, it's just turning to sunset here in the UK, so
I know.
Ready for an interesting chat about what's happened this week.
I gotta get used to this whole Kevin not coming to us from outside in the sunlight. Like, it's taking me a while to process this, Kevin.
If we did a morning show, it could be in the sunlight, but it's
I'll tell you what, I'm not doing a morning show. It's too early. I'm not down with that. It's great to have you both here. I actually missed last night's All About Android, so thankfully I'll get a chance to kind of talk about some of the Android Google news that you guys talked about last night.
There's a bunch of interesting stuff, and we missed you a lot. And you can go to twit.tv/AAA to see us missing you real time. Because I believe at the top of the show I was going, oh, Jason, why aren't you here? But I'm glad that we get our time in now with This Week in Google, and we can talk about Android.
That's so right. Why don't we kick it off with something that I feel like is pretty familiar, familiar space for all of us? And I can't remember, Kevin, do you have a Pixel phone? Are you Pixel right now?
I have a Pixel phone, yes.
Okay, so we're all, Kevin and I are the Pixel. Ron, you're still hanging out with the Robin.
I'm still hanging out with the Robin, although I have come to the conclusion that the moment that the Essential phone in that green color and that green and gold combination goes, I'm going to put my money down. I'm going to do it. I'm getting ready to move on from the next bit Robin, which, by the way, I feel like it's not on the dock. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned this earlier. Nope. Did you see that Amazon is selling the Nextbit Robin for $117 now?
I didn't see that. $117. So would you recommend it for $117? I mean, it's your jam.
It's a complete no-brainer. If you're looking for a phone, a low-cost Android phone for anyone in your family, or just to get or a test device or anything like that, at $117 from Amazon, like, you cannot beat that price. It's amazing. So I don't know why it's doing it. I don't know if it's a glitch. I don't know if it's a problem. But literally right now on Amazon, it's both colors, both Midnight and Mint. I don't know if they're just getting rid of dead stock as Razer is kind of, you know, winding down the Robin for whatever's going to come next from Nextbit. So it's super cheap. Good deal. Search for it on Amazon. $117.
Yeah, that would be my guess. They're probably trying to blow it out a little bit. Because, I mean, are they coming out with another Robin now that Razer owns it? Or is it going in a completely different direction?
We don't know. Everything that I've heard, and I haven't heard much, to be honest.
Right, there hasn't been much.
Was that Razer acquired Nextbit. They were keeping it as an independent entity, and that they were going to be – Razer was going to, you know, get stuff from Nextbit, and Nextbit would have the support to continue on. So my guess is that there's got to be another – device in the works that they're going to unveil, and that will be like the next one, you know, the next phone. But they stopped selling the Next Bit Robin on their website. They stopped selling anything on their website, and all I've seen is the Robin being on sale at various places. So, you know, I'm curious to see what the plan is, but as far as I know, Next Bit is still an entity.
Okay. So yeah. then Kevin, you had said that you were a little bit out of tune with like the Now news. Did you catch the Essential news from, I think it was at this point a week or two ago, Randy Rubin's kind of follow up?
Yes, I did see that. Yeah. That's kind of interesting.
Did it peak? Is it something that you would consider kind of moving away from the Pixel 4? I think this is the question that a lot of like Android fans are asking themselves. Do you stick with the Google or do you go with the father of Google?
Well, I had a Sidekick, so I've had Andrew Rubin design phones for, what's that, 12 years now? No, more.
Yeah.
40 years now. Yeah, it was about that time. Yeah.
2003. So, I'm not completely convinced yet. I'm intrigued by it, and I'm also intrigued by the rumors about the operating system for the home and those pieces, but that's all rumors. There's vaporware at the moment. Right. So it's one of those wait-and-see things, yes. I do tend to buy the latest Google phone and keep that. I don't change it that often. Maybe once every 18 months or so. So right. when I moved to the UK, I got this one. Before that, I had the original Nexus 6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's a pretty nice looking phone. There was this news that I know you guys talked about last night and all about Android.
Yep.
That I mean, initially when we heard about the Essential phone, it was Andy Rubin just basically saying, we're going unlocked, we're selling it through our own channels, we're not going to be in any carrier stores. And now suddenly, Essential has an exclusivity deal with Sprint that basically means that you're going to be able to go into a Sprint store and find the Essential phone. It'll still work on all U.S. carriers, so it's not like this phone only works on Sprint. It's just Sprint, as far as we know, as of this point, is the only carrier store here in the U.S. where you could actually go in and see it being displayed on the shelves and have the representatives point you in that direction. And the Essential president, Niccolo De Masi, told USA Today, this is how the news broke, we like to bet where we think the market is going as opposed to where the market was. He says, I feel like we are a new brand and a new consumer electronics company, and we are partnering with the network of the future. Is Sprint the network of the future?
Well, that was we talked about this last night on All About Android. But Jason, I want to turn it around on you as the host. What do you think of this announcement and this news? Because I have thoughts and opinions, but I don't want to bias you with my thoughts. So I want to hear when you heard this, what was your immediate kind of response?
Oh, well, I mean, I think my knee-jerk response was Sprint, really? But that was my knee-jerk response. But I came around. I came around. Honestly, I think any deal is good when you're talking about getting into carrier stores. Now, this is very U.S.-centric conversation, right? Because the Essential, you know, has, I'm sure Andy Rubin has plans for this to be all over the world. But in the U.S., I mean, in some ways, you live and die by your availability in carrier stores, for right or wrong. And people outside of the U.S., to a certain degree, have a hard time sometimes understanding that, but that's just the way it is here. People will buy from their carrier, whether it's a good or a bad idea, it's there, it's being presented to them, it's being sold to them from a representative. So that can actually really influence the sales numbers on your device. So I think when you're Andy Rubin, you know, trying to guide your new brand to some sort of success, having a deal is better than not having a deal. And it, like, expecting the general consumer to go online and to buy it unlocked and to be able to have that be your strategy for success over the next however many years, I don't think that happens. I think at some point you have to figure out your way into a carrier store. If they can get into Sprint and they can prove that it has some sort of momentum, they get Sprint's kind of money, you know, marketing muscle behind it, Sprint's going to be pretty happy to have, you know, the father of Android's newest phone. So they're probably going to at least make some sort of a big deal about it. That could be really good for the Essential brand.
So that is
one big...
After you, Kevin. Sorry.
I mean, that is one big difference moving back to the UK, is that here you can buy Sims in any shop. I mean, literally any shop. Like, shop you buy your newspapers and sweets from, they'll have a little rack of Sims up there for £1 each, and you buy them, and then you can top them up there as well. Mm-hmm. So pay-as-you-go Sims here. We have phones, you know, we have phone stores too. We have more carriers, and there's much more interop. There's much less locked phones and so on. You can do the full contract thing, but you can just by default you tend to get unlocked phones and the ability to swap SIMs in.
So the interesting thing about this, though, is that like my first gut reaction was like, oh, Sprint. Ooh, you know, and I recounted this on All About Android last night as well, too, that I talked to two individual different people and they both had the same opinion, which is like, oh, Essential's going to be on Sprint. Too bad. Nope. You know, and just an immediate shutdown at the S word, as they said it, at Sprint being involved. But then the news broke yesterday, and I dropped it into the chat in the doc if you want to show it. Sprint's offering a free year of unlimited service if you switch to their service.
I didn't see that.
Yeah. So I think that this is really interesting in that I think Sprint's trying to breathe life into their brand. They're doing whatever they can. And they're like, this offer of a free year is a very T-Mobile-esque promotion.
Yeah.
Right. Doesn't that seem very T-Mobile? Like, seems like a T-Mobile's playbook. Right. And, and I think that my guess is that they must have dumped a bunch of money in Essential's pocket in order to get this exclusive. I think that Essential has to get into the carriers. I mean, we've talked about this every time I talk about cell phones. OnePlus is a great phone. Grab somebody on the street, they don't know how to get it.
No.
You know, like we all know that you can buy these phones unlocked. It's not, Kevin, it's not like in the UK with Carphone Warehouse and places like that where there's a different approach to phones in other countries. Here, the millions and millions of people go to the cell phone store and it could be Verizon, it could be Sprint, it could be T-Mobile, it's whatever's in their neighborhood, and they buy whatever phone is there. So if Essential wants to break away from the OnePluses and the Nexbits and all the other, these other kind of, you know, even Huawei, like all these kind of, you know, one-off hardware startups that are trying to break into the U.S. market, they have to get with a carrier. So if it's with Sprint, so be it. Maybe the sales are enough then that when the exclusive ends, then T-Mobile and AT&T want on board.
No.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right. Sprint needs eyeballs. It needs some sort of fire underneath their brand because they're clearly behind the other three at this point. This is totally out of T-Mobile's playbook, and T-Mobile continues to do these things, and T-Mobile, you know, is improving its network, so it's able to kind of back it up at this point. I think this was an opportunity for Sprint to say, hey, here's what has the potential to be a very kind of eye-catching, very buzzworthy device, and it doesn't have a carrier agreement. We're willing to do what needs to happen in order to bring them into our stores to make it comfortable for them. We're there early on, and you know, maybe that ends up, you know, giving a little bit of extra cachet to Sprint. I just don't know how much power the Essential brand will have out of the gate. And I don't think it has very much out of the gate. It has to build that. This is a way to start building.
It's got
to
start somewhere. Yeah, exactly. And with that Sprint offer, there are tons of restrictions and like not all phones and all this sort of stuff. But still, even then, some people are going to get free service. And so I think it's really interesting. And hopefully people give Essential a try through Sprint, and like I'm rooting for Essential just because I'm rooting for innovation in the space.
And you have said that you plan on getting an Essential?
I'm waiting desperately for some date around the, I think it's the, was the ocean blue color? What is it? Is that what it is? We're not ocean blue or ocean green. I forget what the color is, but let's see. I'm going on the website.
But not your
right now.
Standard black, white.
I don't want the black aluminum. Or white. No, that's, I'm the thing that, yeah, it's ocean depths. That's what it's called now. Ocean depths. It's the green phone with the gold kind of bezel or, you know, kind of frame around it. Yeah, like a black or white, that's boring. After with the Nexbit Robin having such a unique looking phone, right. I want to make sure I have unique looking phones. So, yeah.
Let's just hope that the Essential has a little bit more longevity on the design, like on the actual durability of the design than the Nexbit Robin, because your phone's showing a little bit of age, not going to lie.
I've definitely beaten that phone up quite a bit.
But yeah,
I want to put the Essentials titanium case to kind of give it the drop challenge myself. So
titanium's nice and all, but there's also a little bit of ceramic in there, so just be careful. Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to the phone, and I think it's an eye-catching device. And any deal is better than no deal. I also really hope that Sprint doesn't get in there. And, you know, one of the things that Andy Rubin was really kind of very emphatic about was a very kind of cruft-free, true Android experience, no extra kind of, you know, bloat apps on there. And once you start making deals with carriers, at least in the Android space, not in the iOS space, Apple's made the deals to where this doesn't happen, it seems like. But on Android, it ends up meaning that you get a bunch of extra apps and icons that maybe you do or do not want there. So hopefully that doesn't happen with this, but I guess we'll see. So what I was originally going to talk about, but I'm happy we started with the essential first, is kind of this, we've suddenly have this influx of Pixel news, which I'm a Pixel XL owner. Kevin, you've got the Pixel. Do you have the bigger one or the smaller one?
Oh, the big one. Yeah, the XL.
You've got the XL.
Oh, wow.
So the rumors had been up until now, we've been hearing little bits here and there that there were going to be not one, not two, but three Pixel phones. It was going to be the next generations of the ones we have and then a much larger one or something. I got confused. It's all rumory. It doesn't really matter, I suppose, when it's in the rumor world. But apparently, Android Police is pretty darn confident that the successor to the Pixel XL is actually not happening. Codename Muskie. I love their code names for these phones.
The fish. It's a fish, right?
All around fish. Yes, exactly. In its place, they're going to opt for the even larger Pixel than the XL, so maybe the double XL or whatever they're going to end up calling it. So, and I don't understand. I don't get it. So the Pixel XL right now, the 2016, which is what I have, is 5.5 inches. So I would think that would be a good kind of, you know, that's a decent size to go with the sequel. From what I understand from this, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ron, is that they're not going to be replacing this size with a sequel. They're going to be replacing this size with a larger one. Is that right?
That's the rumor. Yeah, that it's going to be a larger version of it. It's going to be a next gen. And there's also a bunch of other rumors about the chipsets as well. Did you see that hiring announcement? Yeah.
Oh, so, yeah.
Lots of Pixel rumors. We're in the pre-Pixel announcement rumor mode, right?
We are. Yeah. We've done this enough, you know, a number of years now to the point to where we know the phases that we've gone into. Yep. And now that we're in summertime, it's like leading up to Google hardware time for the next couple of months. There's a number of things leaking around this. One of them is that the successor will be larger, but that it'll be a narrower screen ratio. So similar to what we see with the Samsung Galaxy S8, S8 yep. Plus, it's a larger screen, but you know, it's taller essentially and narrower, less bezel, of course, because everybody's going less bezel. And that was that was a big complaint that people had about the Pixel, is that it loved its bezels. At least at the top and bottom.
And what do I always say, Jason? The future is bezel-less.
Yes. I don't know how I feel about that. Bezel never bothered me. I don't know. Kevin, you've lived with this device. Did the top and bottom bezels ever stick out to you sorely?
I preferred it when I had one that was black around the edges rather than white, but this was the one that they had in stock, so I've got the one that's white. But, you know, there's dead space there.
Yeah. There's dead space.
I could use a bit less space and be more useful, but you've still got the challenge of what you do with where you put the cameras when you shrink the bezel. So
exactly. Yeah. Well, and I mean, if you take a look at what what Essential did, they just notched out the display. They were like, yeah, well, the camera's going to go there. We'll just put the display around it in a little U shape. I think it looks a little weird. Ron, I love it.
I think it's great. The weirder, the better.
Yeah, exactly. So that's going to work for that. What's up, Kevin?
As long as you're like, something you're trying to read isn't under it, you know, that's the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of the questions that I have, right? It's right up there in the notification pane. Is that going to require some sort of custom, like, work? You know what I mean? Like, you can't have your notifications hidden because the notch is taken out and the OS doesn't recognize that. I'm sure they'll have that figured out, but...
Yeah. I got to imagine they're smart enough to figure that out for whatever reason. But so if the Essential phone hadn't come out, I was eyeing the Pixel as my next phone. And I was in that mode of, am I going to wait for the Pixel 2 or not? And maybe wait till the Pixel 2 gets announced and get the Pixel at a cheaper price, like that sort of thing. But I got to admit, from the few times I've seen the new Samsung Galaxy phone, I like the longer, thinner style one. I think the fat big version is like I don't know. It's something about the long Samsung phone that I think that's a good aspect ratio for phones moving forward. And yes, it's hard to get your thumb all the way down to the top, but so you two hand it, you know, like it's not the end of the world. But then usually I fall for the, you know, the 5.5-inch kind of size, the smaller size phone anyway. So I doubt I'd even buy either of them. So it doesn't really matter. But yeah, I do like the longer version.
I would agree. I would agree, actually. I would not be and we saw that from the 6. Like I had the 6 before the 6P, which was fatter than this one. And I mean you couldn't even reach across to the other side of the screen with one hand. It was definitely a two-handed thing. I've definitely noticed the slimmer they're getting, even though they're increasing the screen size, they're able to kind of maximize the size of the device around the display, make it a little slimmer so it's easier to use with one hand, but still have kind of the overall size and dimension of the phone one-handable. You know what I mean? It's bigger, but it's not because they're reducing the bezels. So there's that trend that is apparently potentially going to come to this rumored Pixel sequel. 4 gigs of RAM, octa-core CPU, which Snapdragon 835 is what's expected there. And I mean, other things. Let's see here. What was the next one? LG is apparently potentially going to be working on this device. With the Pixel that we have now, it was made by Google. But then when you really got under the hood, you realize it was made by Google with HTC support. And apparently that's going to go in the direction of LG this time instead of HTC. Very curious about that. Why do you guys think that might be? Any wild guesses?
I mean, historically, they flip back and forth between the different builders, haven't they? What do you call it? The Nexus was LG, wasn't it? At least one of them was.
Oh, yeah. They had
The Nexus 5 was LG.
The legendary Nexus. Yeah.
My favorite phone of all time. Yeah, exactly. So.
Yeah. But I mean, I think with the Pixel universe, Google really wanted to make a statement and say, well, these aren't deals that we're making with anyone else. These are our phones. Like they want to pull an Apple and be like, we're doing this all in-house, which ties into other things that we're hearing. This all kind of threads together.
Think about Motorola again?
What's that?
They're going to buy Motorola again?
Would that be a good thing or a bad thing at this point? I don't even know. So apparently Google hired Apple veteran chip engineer Manu Galati after 8 years with Apple. Google has big plans to kind of move its chip production in-house. Galati has 27 years of industry experience. He worked 15 years at AMD and Broadcom before his 8 years at Apple. While he was at Apple, it coincided with the company switching to its own chips, using them in the iPad in 2010 with the A4 chip and beyond. So big time coordinator and engineer around Apple's switch to in-house chip production. Google's bringing him on. They've also got jobs posted for other engineers on the SoC side of things. And what does that say for Google's hardware? You know, when it's creating its chips, we heard David Burke and, you know, other Google execs at Google I.O. talking about, you know, hardware embedded in the phones that they create that tie directly into things that, you know, aid in advanced artificial intelligence and machine learning and all this kind of stuff. What does it mean when Google brings all of this stuff in-house? Is it good to have it all vertically integrated the way a company like Apple does? Do you think that would be a good thing for Google's efforts, Kevin?
They do have some experience building hardware, custom hardware themselves, but they've previously done it for data centers. So they do have a bunch of chip experience in that realm, but it's a very different realm than this. So it would make sense to bring someone in who knows, you know, this sort of low power domain much better. I think they are big enough and they have enough money to afford to do some of this. So that does make some sense. Mm-hmm. It's a question of, you know, is this what they're going to, you know, now they've been pulling back from lots of the moonshot stuff. Is this they're going to spend their money and become more like Apple or, you know, to some extent, even like Microsoft? Microsoft has been doing a little bit of this as well. Yeah. So it makes sense if you look at Google at the sort of Alphabet level, it would make sense for them to do this as an Alphabet company, I would think. But if they're doing it as part of Google, that's interesting too.
That's true. Yeah. What part of the umbrella would this hardware add, or would it fall under Rick Osterloh? Like, is this firmly in the hardware camp, or Rick Osterloh, formerly of Motorola, he now kind of leads the hardware division at Google. Does he oversee that whole effort, especially in the sense that it all kind of ties into the hardware, like the Pixel line that they're creating everything? Ron, it looked like you had something to say.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, like, I think the combination of the rumor of LG making the next Pixel phone plus this hire of Manu Gulati are all kind of indicators. Like, I'm not surprised LG is being tapped for the next Pixel phone because, like Kevin said, for years they've spread the wealth. Like, they've never favored one manufacturer over the other, and I think that has been done to maintain those relationships, you know, to kind of keep everybody happy. But also they're inching ever closer to the identity of the Pixel and the Google phone. You know, like the branding on, like, this past time with the Pixel was so strongly Google. It was like, you know, like it was we knew what was under the hood, but the average person thought it was Google. And I think that hiring Manu Gulati and looking into doing the chipset and then maybe the hardware is, again, like, I feel like it's a repeat of a couple of years ago, but it's Google dipping their toe back into the water of saying, okay, well, what if we bring all this in-house and we do this all and we don't have a partner? And I feel like it's a tightrope that they're walking, because on one hand, you get the sense that they really want to own a phone. They really want to own the phone business if they can, right? They want to compete with Apple and Samsung. But on the other hand, with Android, they have all these OEMs and all these partners that they need to keep happy. And so it feels like they're trying to, you know, kind of keep both sides happy.
Well, and the other thing is to map this to the rest of the sort of Google point of view on this. You know, so they've been building stuff for the data center for a long time. As I said, they've basically been building out custom machines to be data center machines. They've also built their own switches to control systems there, and now they've moved to the TensorFlow, the TPU. So part of this may be drawing some of that back to, if they're taking this big bet on AI, it may be that they want to put a TPU in the phone as well, and get that to a low power design as well. So that may make sense for them to, you know, if you're looking at the next generation of Android or the generation after that you're going to want custom chips for that. And if they're going to keep up the VR stuff they're doing, they're going to want custom chips for that as well. So there's potentially a set of integrations that they want to do to make sure that, so hiring someone who's an expert at pulling multiple subunits together into one chip and keeping the power low is a very smart move from that point of view.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, and it's that idea of holistic development of that. Listen, we want a device that can do this on the software side instead of leaning on Qualcomm or whomever else that's making chipsets or processors or, you know, whatever components. Let's just oversee the components ourselves. And who knows, you know, like, maybe, you know, Manu Gulati and the team that's working on this stuff designs the chipsets, but then they outsource the production of it to like a Foxconn or whoever else. You know, like, there's a bunch of different ways this plays out.
Yeah, I mean, spot on. And they even talked about that at Google I/O, right? TensorFlow Lite is their effort to bring that machine learning into the device itself. David Burke had said, you know, silicon on the device that's dedicated to this machine learning stuff going forward. So if they're creating their SoC, I mean, right now, everybody in Android is using, I mean, not everybody, but almost everybody's using Qualcomm chips in their devices. And while that's great, because Qualcomm obviously is doing, you know, a great job creating their systems on a chip to power these smartphones, it also has, there's a lot of feature parity. Like, everybody's kind of offering the same things because the chipset offers the same things. Google brings in its own, or, you know, Alphabet, Google, whatever, brings in their own team to create this stuff on their own. They can more tightly integrate that with their efforts like TensorFlow Lite and really create something that differentiates the hardware that they're creating compared to the rest, so that they can coexist, but we offer some, and, you know, Google's already shown that they're fine with offering things that other phones don't have. You know, for years, that was the question is, Google doesn't want to compete with its competitors because it might scare them away. You know, they'd be too big and too dominant. But now it's obvious, like, Google thinks that it can coexist with its competitors and offer different things on its devices and, I don't know, swim in the same pool. But so there's that. Also, by the way, LG, another aspect to that is that there was a rumor that Google wanted to invest in LG's flexible OLED displays. So maybe there's some sort of crossover there as well. They all seem
that
to
would-
be. Yeah.
That would be wonderful. I do like flexible displays.
I mean, I doubt that means you'd get your phone and you could bend it. But I think
I want a phone that I can roll up and put in my pocket like a newspaper.
Someday, Ron. Someday.
Someday. I'll have it.
We're just not there yet.
I believe, Jason. I believe in it.
More than likely, it'll be kind of the edging, you know, the rounded edges, which is what we see right now with Samsung devices, which, by the way, allows for a, you know, less bezel in your device. That's one way to kind of make that happen, and that's one way that they're pulling that off. So I feel like that was a lot of rumor in one short.
Well, and the funny thing is, though, what I think is really interesting is that here we are in June, and when is the Pixel announcement going to be? Like, we were betting last night, like I said September, Florence Ion said October. Right. But we're still 3 months out. So if these are the rumors we're getting at least 3 months or so out, what is August going to be like?
Oh, boy. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the last hardware announcement was the beginning of October, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
So if you were to follow the year.
And that was late. That was that felt really late, didn't it?
It did feel a little late.
Yeah.
Just real quick here. Google has announced kind of end of life dates for the devices that you might have or that you probably have. The Pixel and the Pixel XL are going to stop getting operating system updates on October 2018. So that's next October. Those dates, like, I have to imagine they'd have their successor around when these updates stop. So it's probably October at the latest that you'd have the new devices. And then security updates October 2019. Basically, Google has dedicated themselves on their devices to 2 years of OS updates, from what I understand, from what I remember, 3 years of security updates. Not quite as long as you get on the iOS side of things, but better than before, where we just didn't know.
Yeah, exactly.
And then 6P, 5X, they're going to end support September 2018. I think that's security support September of next year. And then the 6 and the 9 will stop getting security updates this October. So just in case you have those devices now, you know. Did I miss anything in that block? I don't know. Is this getting you guys excited for the next wave of Pixel devices?
Well, I need to see more before I'm excited. I don't think I'm at excitement level yet.
You're already all in on the Essential, so.
I'm on the Essential hype train. That's for sure. But also some of the, you know, like Google released the Android O Developer Preview 3.
Oh yeah, that's right.
A couple of days ago. Yeah, and so like that, and while that's still not like they say that was a big release because it has all the APIs now, and apparently they squashed a bunch of bugs. But because I'm not running it, I don't know if it's more stable. So Jason, I'm curious once you install it whether it'll make your Pixel more stable, because I know you've been having stability issues.
Yeah, so I updated to the Android O update at Google I/O basically when they announced it there. It was the official kind of move over to the automated system. So I opted into that. It took a couple of days for it to happen, but I got it on eventually. And then, I was having a lot of weird bugs. Like, I'd try and install apps from my computer. Like, you know how you can go to the Play Store on your desktop and say, install this on my phone, and it would appear there. And it just wouldn't install. And for whatever reason, I would restart everything. I couldn't get half the apps I wanted to install on. I did get this update, though. The OTA came a couple of days ago, and I updated. And I haven't had any issues since. But I've also kind of been not looking at my phone a whole lot, so... So there's that too. But so far, so good. I'm curious, Kevin, if you've had a chance to like look at the Android O feature set or play around with any of the developer preview, or do you keep your device clean and pristine like most people do?
I don't normally go for the developer previews unless I've got something I'm specifically developing. Yeah. And if I would, I wouldn't do it on this one. I'd get another one to try that on, I think, because you need one phone that's not falling over. I did upgrade to N early, but that was basically because the previous software update managed to brick my phone, so I had to do that.
I encountered that too. That's right. The only way to like update it was to go to the beta. That's right. Strange how that worked. But it worked. Hey, I was happy that it existed, because otherwise I thought my phone was dead in the water for good. But yeah, so far so good. Yeah. I'm happy with the change. You know, it doesn't seem to be crashing or anything like that. So there's that, I guess. But I mean, would I recommend it for like everybody? Probably not. There's probably enough bugs in there that you don't want to jump into it unless you're cool.
Yeah, with the fact that I would say to wait until like at least four, if not release number five, before you start thinking about it. The closer we get to September, that's when you want to do it, absolutely, if at all. Because it's absolutely a developer preview. It's not a user preview. It's a developer preview.
Right. Real quick, I guess what we can do, we can round out a little bit of the Android stuff, and then I have to take a break. But Google had just announced that they're highlighting. Didn't they just do this? They're highlighting Android excellence, basically apps and games that are really, really good in their categories in a program called Android Excellence. So they're collections curated by Google. They're picking these based on, you know, apps and games that follow best practices, have great design, performance, optimizations, localization. I don't know.
How is this any different than the end of the year awards that came out 6 months ago?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe an ongoing thing. Yeah. I don't know. I'm sure there's good apps to mine in there for the arena, though.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And then you guys, I know you guys talked about this last night. I haven't had a chance to play around with it. Gboard, which is the keyboard that I use on Android, because I think it's kind of like Google's default keyboard now, right, is Gboard.
Yeah, it's really the go-to. I don't know if it comes pre-installed. Does it come pre-installed on the Pixel or not? But it should if it doesn't. But no, this is the Gboard is interesting because it's also cross-platform in that it's both Android and iOS, which I think is great. But the recent Gboard app added the ability to suggest phrases, which is something that SwiftKey had about a year ago or so. So as you're typing something, it's not only predicting the next word, but predicting the rest of the sentence based off commonly used phrases. And then also the ability to draw an emoji and have it match the emoji and have that go in. So if you feel the need to draw the poo emoji, you can do that. I don't really know the drawing emoji thing. I don't know. I guess people want that. I just tap the emoji.
Well, but, I understand it though. I understand it because I'm in this weird, I'm old school, right? Like I've realized, like if I want to do a smiley face, I do the colon and the parentheses. And then I realize I'm totally old school. You know, just lame people do that. You got to step into the emoji age. So then I'm like, okay, great. I'll step into the emoji age. And then I spend 10 minutes trying to find this stupid face that actually represents my feeling. I'm like, so what am I doing wrong? Like, no one takes this long to find like a face that represents their emotion. Or do they?
So if you draw it, do you like, I need to express myself by drawing this emoji that I'm feeling. Like,
if that's going to get me there quicker, then yes, I will. I'm down for that. I'm fine with that.
Well, what I don't understand is that why, like, so I'm a heavy WhatsApp user, and WhatsApp actually converts the colon and parentheses to the smiley emoji.
Okay,
like they're
down with that.
So like, why Gboard can't do that? I don't know. But one other feature on Gboard that I do like is that they have enlarged arrow buttons to allow you to navigate text, which is fantastic because as someone with fat fingers and a small screen, and if you're trying to do edits on like a document on your phone, it's a nightmare. And so being able to go tap, tap, up, 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 left, 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 you know, like that sort of thing is a great addition as well too. So I love the Gboard. It's my go-to keyboard now. So
Kevin, where do you stand on Emoji Gate, Kevin?
I still use SwiftKey, and what SwiftKey has is if you type a word, it'll suggest an emoji that belongs with the word. So that is my shortcut for it. So rather than typing, you know, shrug or whatever, rather than looking for the shrug emoji, I'll type shrug and it'll suggest me the shrug emoji or train or poodle or whatever it is.
Usually in my case, I'm trying to find the poo emoji. You'd think it would like appear easier for me and know that I'm looking for the poo emoji because I use it so much.
Go-to emoji, man.
No, I wish that it were. I just don't use emoji at all because I find it way more inconvenient than I feel like it should be. Meanwhile, we have guests here in the studio.
That's why the SwiftKey is good. Because you'll just be typing normally, it'll suggest you an emoji instead of along with the two words it suggests you as well.
Yeah, right? that's the way to go about it.
That's actually helpful.
As I was describing, the hours and hours it takes me to find a face that represents how I feel, our guests here in the studio were like, yeah, that's what you do. It takes that long. That's just the way it goes. So apparently I need to just like let go of it and realize it's going to take me a long time to get that face.
what I've done in this emoji filled world now is that I just use nonsense emojis. Like, I'll be texting somebody and I'll end it with the smiley face of the cowboy hat, or I'll end it with the volcano, or like, or the cactus. And everyone's like, what does that mean? I'm like, I don't know.
You got to be careful, Ron.
Yeah, exactly.
You might say something and you don't have no idea what you're saying in emoji.
All the better. All the better.
I just thought of a Google Gboard feature. What you should do is you should be able to pull a face at the screen and it'll give you the right emoji based on your expression.
Wait a minute. They showed something like this off a few months ago, right?
Aloe rolled off. I think that's, it's an aloe.
Yes.
It was a facial recognition. They made stickers based on your face. So not necessarily emojis, but more stickers, like, you know, the kind of, you know, the Bitmoji type thing. That was, remember, Jason, you did it and it looked kind of like you, but not totally.
And I'm not going to go into my aloe because there's a bunch of chats there and I just don't trust myself. Not in this mind state. But yes, there is a way to do that. And it made a Bitmoji thing. I thought there was a way to interpret your face into an emoji, though. And if that doesn't exist, Google. You're the ones to make this happen. Do it. Get on that. That's important stuff. Way more important than shaming people into getting solar panels on their roof, which we'll talk about here in a few minutes. Before we move on, let's thank the sponsor of today's episode, and that is Capterra. There's a reason that you got into business, if you got into business. It wasn't to worry about tracking job applicants or to figure out email marketing. So it's best to not let that stuff dominate your time. There's software that can handle all of the day-to-day busy work for you, and you just need to find it. It's as easy as that. Capterra helps you find and compare the software solutions for your business needs. It's an easy-to-use website, over 400 categories of software to choose from, app development, business continuity, content marketing, file sharing, human resource, web analytics, and a whole lot more. Their comprehensive directory includes more than 30,000 software solutions. Enough in there to get you started, at least. Capterra provides thousands of verified peer reviews and ratings from software users who are just like you. So you also find articles, find reports, buying guides, all that stuff to help you in your software search. Small and large businesses turn to Capterra to find the right software solution. So you won't waste time sorting through search engine results. You find your software solution with Capterra, and you get back to the most important thing, and that's running your business. Whether you need help with website building or customer service, everyone needs help with customer service, in my opinion, or project management, Capterra is the place to go. And the best part is that Capterra is absolutely free. There's no obligation. You don't need to register. It's a free resource. It's going to help you make the right software decision. So do what you do better. Join the millions who use Capterra every month to find software solutions for their business. Visit capterra.com/twig, and you can start your free software search today. That's capterra.com/twig, and we thank Capterra for their support of This Week in Google. All right. Well, I teased it, so I guess it's by no means the top Google news, but Project Sunroof, which is basically Google's map project that can tell how much sunlight is hitting your roof to see. Basically, you can use this to see if solar panels might actually be a good fit for your home. I would love to get solar panels on my home. Actually, maybe not even solar panels, solar tiles. You know, the Tesla tiles. Those things are hot. But anyways, this is literally
hot.
Yeah. You probably don't want to walk up there. But this is a way where you can essentially, Google is using their artificial intelligence, as they use for everything, their machine learning algorithms, to take a look at solar imagery, satellite imagery, rather, and recognize solar panels and be able to tell you if your neighbors are converted to solar or not, in the hopes that, I don't know if it's the hope or not, but it's probably going to, you know, make you feel kind of bad that you aren't, and then make you want to get solar converted.
Didn't they do this last year, though? I've got a flashback. So what changed?
I think the change is the analysis, the AI analysis. That's what, because I remember this too. They released this a few years ago, and I think then basically what it was a way to determine how much sun actually hits your roof throughout a given day to determine whether it would be a good idea for you to get it. And now what they're doing is they're training their AI to determine who's done it and who hasn't, so that you feel guilty and you get solar on your roof.
But how do you feel guilty if you're not checking it?
Well, that's true. Who's right? Like, who's actually checking it? It's a good point.
If I'm not aware of it, then how would I be feel shamed? You know, like, no, but I think this is cool because, like, maybe you see your neighbor and you're like, you've done it, and you're like, oh, cool. And if my whole block does it, then we can save this X amount, and you want to talk your neighbors into it or whatever. But yeah, this just looks like an evolution of what they did last year.
That's pretty much what it is. Yeah. It's this growing trend.
Can it detect those Tesla roofs?
I know.
They look like ordinary roofs.
Oh, man. Those things are hot. I want those so bad. But we don't need a new roof at this point on our house. It's like, I don't know if I could justify that. I'd have to go with the solar panels. Basically, Tesla says, if you already need a new roof, this is the way to go. Cost effective, you know, from cost effectiveness, you might as well replace it with this, and over time it'll pay for itself. If you don't need a new roof, you might as well stick with panels. But man, they look nice with those solar tiles.
Hey, listen, just because that's the conventional wisdom, Jason, doesn't mean you have to stick to it. If you want those tiles, I want you to have the tiles.
Yep, they're expensive.
I know.
Someday, maybe I'll win the lottery, although I don't play the lottery. Who knows? Anyways, that was probably not the top Google story. Let's see. What do we have in here? There aren't really a whole lot of top Google stories, to be honest. So I'll just kind of start up here at the top. Google's, you know, the little self-driving cars, the totally characteristic. I think they had some promo videos, the little two-seaters. Yep. People get in them. They look like these little futuristic pods. They're autonomous vehicles, and they were basically Google's way of showing what the, you know, autonomous driving future may look like. They began testing on roads back in 2014. Apparently, those are going away. Yeah, those little guys.
Aww.
The Firefly is
going away. They're basically golf carts, aren't they? I mean,
more than anything, that's probably what it does.
Yeah, they only went like 25, 30 miles an hour, right? So
Top speed, 25 miles per hour. You're not going very fast, but there is a stop and go button inside, and I appreciate it for its simplicity. Apparently, they logged in 3 million miles in 3 years, and Google / Alphabet has decided it's probably best to just focus all of its efforts on the thing most people have heard of, which is Waymo, which is taking the roads by storm at this point, or about to.
And the courtrooms.
That too, yeah. There's some there's some stuff going down with Waymo in the courtrooms and Uber.
Yeah.
And a whole lot more about Uber, but we don't need to talk about that. Google Drive, apparently, is – I think this is a great idea, although I wonder how expensive it would get over time. But Google is going to release a new app called Backup and Sync. They're going to release it on June 28th. And basically what it's going to be designed for is pointing it to any file or folder – or sorry, folder, not file – folder on your drive or number of folders, and have continuous sync backup to the cloud. When I read this, I was like, man, I just assumed that they already did that, but I guess they don't. I think they did that in photo upload, but not in just general file upload.
Yeah, no, I don't think they've ever done the entire thing, like a true Dropbox style kind of backup kind of situation. But hey, man,
we've done it with folders, surely.
Yes, yeah, photos for photos, sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. They're folders. You got to.
Oh, you could.
Yeah.
Okay. So then this is meant to be.
At least I've had that before. Yeah. I'm slightly confused.
Okay. So they say that they're replacing the Google Drive app and the Google Photos backup app on desktop with this. So it's probably going to do what it's done before, also the Photos backup.
I see. Okay. No, because I mean, I've had the opposite problem, which is that if I install Google Drive, then my hard drive fills up because my Google Drive has got more stuff on it than my computers have. So,
yeah, that's a problem.
Because I got a terabyte with whatever it was with the Chrome, the Chrome Pixel years ago. So I just threw everything in it, and then I bought a new Mac, and it didn't have enough storage to sync to it.
So you still have a terabyte from when you bought the Pixel?
No, it expired at Google I/O last year, so now I'm paying them for it.
Oh, okay. was like, wow, you got off easy if you still have that. That's awesome.
That was the irony. So it was like it was Google I.O. week, and suddenly all my Google things were saying, you are out of disk space by a factor of 10. You need to delete like 90% of your stuff. And it's like, it's I.O. week, Google. Oh, right. Yes, my 3-year freebie just expired. Now I've got to start paying you. Damn.
But isn't that how they get you, right? There's actually totally related news to this. Amazon got rid of their unlimited file storage. They had, you know, a few years ago rolled out their unlimited cloud storage plan. They're ending that. If you have an existing unlimited storage plan, you won't lose it until the renewal. But then at that point, you'll be downgraded essentially to a 1 terabyte plan, and you'll have to pay extra, $59.99 per extra terabyte. Or $11.99 per 100 gigs per month. And then if you don't purchase any extra data after like 6 months, all that data just disappears. But it's an interesting strategy that we're seeing, where I think there is a certain population of people that saw unlimited and thought unlimited forever. But of course, forever never lasts forever.
Forever does not mean unlimited. Yeah, exactly.
Forever is not forever when you're talking about unlimited, nor is unlimited actually unlimited when you're talking about unlimited. But anyways, so it's a great way to get you in the door. But then what are you going to do? All your data is up there. Now you have to decide, is it worth it for you to pay or do you just kiss it goodbye? You chose to pay. It was important enough for you to keep in the cloud.
Well, it was either that or spend a week deleting 90% of my stuff.
So, exactly.
Or about that, to download all the local drives. But
put you to work.
But basically. I mean, it's like, but I've already delegated photos and music to Google. I mean, you know, those two, they don't have a limit on you. They just let you back stuff up. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, yeah, all my photos, sure, all my music from, you know, that I've got downloaded lots of my machines, sync that up to Google, that's fine. Then my phone doesn't have to have it on.
Right.
And I trust them to back it up because they're Google. They don't actually delete things unless something terrible happens. You know, they don't even delete things if you tell them to delete things. So, you know, by default, Google has 6 copies of everything in more than, and it's in more than one data center in more than one continent. So it's quite hard to lose stuff that you backed up to Google.
As long as you don't lose access to your Google account, everything's okay.
As long as you don't enable.
Just said, it's all wine and roses until you do something stupid.
Until you get locked out of your Google account. Yep.
Until you get locked out of your Google account, it's all gone.
How would that happen? That would never happen.
It would never happen. Except that it did on this very show.
What was it? It was 2-factor authentication plus Google Voice, right?
Yes, it was a deadly combination. Yeah, well, okay, so you brought up Google Photos. This is not in the doc, and it's totally not related to much other than Google Photos, but this is something I was struggling with yesterday. So Google I.O., we were given, one of the few gifts that attendees were given was a 20-page hardcover photo book from Google Photos or whatever. They're like, a free photo book. You choose the photos, we'll give you a free photo book. And so I went into my photos, and my wife and I were like, you know, we never actually got our wedding photos in a book. So this is a perfect opportunity to do that. Let's do that. So I go into Google Photos. I mean, we've got like 1,000 photos. We had a really great photographer that we hired. It was one of the things that we spent the most money on was the photographer, because we were like, you know, this is the thing you're going to remember forever, so you might as well have it look nice. And it turns out that all of our photos from their wedding are duplicated, and the duplicates are sideways. So there's some of them, you know, half of them are the right orientation. Half of them are sideways, but the same. Google can do so much with artificial intelligence. Is it difficult to like detect that a photo is sideways and automatically swap it up? And if not,
have one of those. I've definitely seen that in the assistant tab. It says these photos are sideways. Should I rotate them for you?
But it does that. But so, it does that automatically. How do I do that? How do I say go back into my library?
Yeah, I'd say go in front. That's a good question. I'm not sure you can.
Maybe I can.
Not sure you can ask them to do that. That's true.
Maybe I can. Yeah.
Have you looked on the desktop version of Google Photos as opposed to the app?
What's that, Ron?
Have you looked at the desktop version of Google Photos as opposed to the app?
Yeah, I looked at both, but
okay.
And you know, there's like a keyboard shortcut for rotating, so that helped. It's Shift R if you're looking at a single photo. Shift R, that'll rotate it, so you don't have to find the button. But I just wanted to be like, look at all of these and rotate all of these. And someone in chat posted a thing from the app. Is this a way that you can manually do it? like fire it off.
I've definitely seen one of the, you know, I've definitely seen an assistant thing that said, that found, because I had a bunch of old ones from like, you know, 15 years ago that were all the wrong way around. And it said, these were all rotated the wrong way. Do you want to fix that? And I said, yes. And they were rotated. But I, the problem with the assistant is you can't tell it to do things. It is just like sitting there like gripping your photos and making shit up.
Yeah, if it can't detect it, it's not going to do it. And there must be something in those photos that is making it think it's not sideways. And whether it could be the orientation of a face or something like that, you know, like it's, you know, machine learning is great, but you can still fool it at some point.
Oh, man, there's no denying, like, the majority of these things are head to toe. We're just standing sideways.
Obvious.
So maybe maybe it thinks we're all laying down. I don't know. Anyways, totally random. It looks like, I mean, maybe I can go in here because I know sometimes you can go into the Photos app and you can select a bunch of photos. Well, you do it with photo books. You select a bunch of photos and then you go into the menu and you hit, you know, photo book. Maybe there's something in there to trigger an auto rotate an analysis or something, but I didn't see it yesterday. And I tried on desktop and mobile because I have gotten received that assistant card before for rotating photos, but obviously didn't get to these. So anyways, a little bit of a tangent. Thank you for coming along with me on that journey. This was interesting. Alphabet finally found a buyer for Boston Dynamics. I think they've been trying to unload their robots for about a year now, and now SoftBank is the proud owner of a whole bunch of robots. Also, not only Boston Dynamics, but Shaft, which was also an Alphabet property that you probably heard a lot less about. They were also creating robots. They had released a bipedal robot last year, or at least a video of one last year that was designed to help carry heavy loads. So kind of doing some similar stuff to what Boston Dynamics was, but maybe a little bit smaller, more compact. I'm not really quite sure. I think the first thing I thought of when I read this is that there's no chance I'm ever going to run into a Boston Dynamics robot at Google I.O. It's just not going to happen now. And Ron, that makes me sad.
Well, I'm glad because the bipedal robots freak me out, and they freak me out almost as much as the quadrupedal robots, like the dog robots. Those freak me out the most. But I'm more interested in it. It just seems like every time something interesting is happening, it seems SoftBank is involved. SoftBank is really in, like, they're really, and there's all this stuff about how they're restructuring this $93 billion tech fund and doing, you know, and they invested in Sprint and they pulled the investment from Essential. Like, it just seems that like SoftBank keeps coming up in these kind of interesting tech stories. And I'm curious, what are they going to do with Boston Dynamics and Shaft? Like, that's really kind of interesting. So who knows?
Masayoshi Son, chairman and CEO of SoftBank Group Corp, said in a statement, "Smart robotics are going to be a key driver of the next stage of the information revolution."
Yep.
That kind of, like, I don't know what that means. Does that mean that these robots are going to be delivering my information on a platter, or what that means? But I mean, there's no doubt robotics are, you know, a future or a part of our future. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts? Any theories on why a company like SoftBank might want robots, Kevin?
Who knows? I mean, yeah, robots have been a sort of cool thing in Japan for years, so it makes sense for a Japanese company to pick it up. But I don't know. It's one of those bizarre things. It's like, you know, Those robots seem really cool, but also seem really weird and off-putting. They're a bit too uncanny valley for me.
Yes, agreed.
That's why they're awesome. That's why they're awesome and scary all at the same time.
But if you look at sort of Asimo and Aibo and the Japanese style ones, they put a lot of effort into making them cute and friendly.
That's true.
Whereas the Boston Dynamics ones were just like, they were just scary. They just look like, you know, evil robot dogs rather than cuddly robot dogs.
Yeah, they definitely had a military edge to them. Like, you could definitely see those out on a battlefield somewhere.
I just see the Star Wars prequels. So I don't want to see that.
It's the future, Ron. It's the future. Well, I mean, speaking of Toyota, Osimo is Toyota, right? Is it Osimo? I think is what it's called. Toyota had apparently been in the running, according to reports as well, on buying Boston Dynamics. They lost out to SoftBank. So Osimo's just going to have to be queued on his own.
Was Honda, by the way.
Oh, was that Honda? Sorry, I got
it. Was Honda.
Got that wrong. Yep.
The world's most advanced humanoid robot.
It's pretty cool, but not nearly as frightening as Big Dog. I really hope the SoftBank keeps up the tradition and allows Boston Dynamics to continue to release the videos, because pretty much it's like Christmas anytime Boston Dynamics releases a new video of their robots. Every time I open it and I watch it and I mouth agape and I'm like, this is actually happening. I once thought that this would just be science fiction, but no, here it is invading my nightmares.
I don't know how that's Christmas, or for me, that's like the stuff of nightmares. Every time I see one of those new Boston Dynamics videos of the robot walking awkwardly and not falling down, and oh, it's creepy.
Or being kicked and it doesn't fall down and it comes after
you. That one.
That one's a little scary. If you like your material, as part of your design, then you might like the fact that more material design is coming to Chrome OS. Canary Channel apparently is getting a new material notification design. More streamlined, rounded corners, cleaner icons, condensed actions. And that's about all there is.
It's almost not like small and too gray and illegible like they've done on Android.
Oh, really?
I want a high contrast, larger type back in my notifications, please.
That's true. They're getting so elegant that you need a pair of bifocals to even read them.
Yes.
Because they're condensing all that.
Why is the main text on these things gray? There's no excuse for that.
Doesn't pop, but it looks nice. Yeah. If you want to get in on that action, you can. You just have to enable a flag. Just do a search for it. Get on Canary, of course, and you can enable a flag, and that's all there is to that. I know you guys talked a little bit about local guides last night on All About Android, something that I still only sort of really understand, this local guides thing with maps.
And I didn't even realize that actually Florence Ion was like a level 3 local guide. Like, she's participated in this, which is crazy. But yeah, no, but basically it's just kind of, you know, it's Google's kind of crowdsourced information about locations within maps. And, you know, it allows people to, you know, add information and answer questions and things like that. I do the things in Google Maps where you answer questions about places, but I don't know what level I am. I don't know if that's even tied to local guides. I know local guides has been around for a while, but, you know, it's clearly a program that's working well for them, because here they are, they're adding 5 more levels, which brings it to a total level of 10, and in hopes to kind of keep everybody incentivized to keep using it, keep the gamification going. And they give rewards, like you get free months of Google Play Music and discounted rent and stuff like that. So it's pretty neat, but it's not something I have any, like, I barely have time to work on my projects, much less Google's projects.
Exactly. A couple of free months of Google Play Music. Don't they just offer that every other month anyways for things?
Well, that's it. It's kind of weird because it keeps nagging me to do that. It's like, okay, you're at this place. Do you want to tell me about it? It's like, no, I don't want to tell you about it, but...
Well, the way I look at it is that I participate in that because the way I see it is, like, this is information I would want to know. Like, because I go to Google Maps all the time and look up, like, what are the dollar signs are, when is this place busy, like all that sort of stuff. And so I figure you got to pay it forward a little. I got to give some information as well too. So it says, like, does this place take credit cards? And I say, I don't know. And then I move on. You know, so
pay it forward with uncertainty.
Sure.
I've already done that with Foursquare, so it feels like I'm having to do it twice. It's like, you know, can you just, like, talk to Dennis and get some data from him?
Yeah, I know. No, I know. I completely agree. I get that notification, or I'll arrive somewhere, and then I get a buzz and look down at my phone, and there it is. Like, it knows that I arrived there. It's one of those moments where it's like, ah. But I mean, you know, props for it actually getting it right. I never apparently afford myself the time to actually do very much with it, unless it's a really quick, like, yes, no. But to, like, so type out a review is just, I never give myself the time to do that.
It's important to note, though, that those questions we're talking about are a function of Google Maps in terms of crowdsourcing information. Those are not local guides. I just went to maps.google.com/local guides, and you actually have to join and tell it what city you're in and agree, you know, kind of agree to their terms and all stuff like that. You got to choose to join. Once you do that, then you can submit information about places and locations and things like that. And it's kind of like, it's basically like Google's Yelp baked into Google Maps.
Got it.
But it gives you that really kind of in-depth information, and that's how they do the rewards and all things like that. I think it's cool. It's interesting. I'm glad that they're doing it. I just don't know why. Like, it's the kind of thing, like, you know, Jason, you and I are so close to all this stuff, and I just learned that right now in the past 2 minutes. You know, like, it's not something that's, like, widely popularized. They don't bubble it up within the Google Maps app that much, which I thought they would do, so.
Yeah, I mean.
No, they do. It's pretty, yeah. I see it all the time. Do you not get that?
Oh, you know, I get it, I don't know that these people are local guys and what levels they are and things like that.
Oh, I see. I've got you, yeah.
Like how you would even know to jump in there, but I guess man, is this the thing? I feel like at some point I heard about it where if you are already contributing a lot, if you're just kind of that person that likes to contribute a lot, then you get contacted and it's like you can be part of the local guides, and that's when you get in on kind of these bonuses. And from what I understand, like, it was 5 stages before, and the problem is, like, their best users would get to the 5th stage, the 5th level or whatever. They'd level up, and then that's about as high as you could get. And it's like, okay, well, what is my incentive to continue contributing? Now they've added 5 more levels so that you can continue to get more as you contribute more. And that, you know, gives other users more information to pull from, I suppose.
Yeah.
In our constant march towards an AI ruled future, the New York Times apparently has enlisted Alphabet AI to help it moderate its comments. Hey, more power to the AI that can moderate comments, because I have to imagine that's not an easy task. But it's actually really interesting. Only 10% of New York Times articles allow for comments at this, at least prior to this, because the task of moderating all of those comments with the limited staff that they have dedicated to it, I mean, it just take too much time. So they could only allow comments for 10% of their articles. Alphabet steps in with their Jigsaw division. They created a tool called Perspective that is allowing the New York Times to expand the number of articles that they're allowing comments on. They plan to open up commenting on 80% of the articles. And when you consider somewhere around 200 articles per day being posted, that's quite a lot of moderation. The New York Times articles get a lot of comments when you go to one that has comments activated. So the AI algorithm essentially is scanning for known, you know, things that would trigger a flag, and then it can kind of pass things off as need be to human moderators to make the calls or whatever. But it's just trimming the easy stuff, letting most of it pass if it passes, and if not, kind of passing the questionable stuff off to humans. So AI taking one for the team in this case.
If someone's gonna read the comments, it might as well be a robot.
Yeah.
Well, I like the comment was, it says, that I like was, the tool sometimes proved imperfect, missing some modern slurs. That's the idea that we've got continually reinventing slurs on other people to get past the robots.
Yes. There's one thing we know about the internet.
Can you be more creative in your abuse, please?
Right. Come up with something new and let's all jump on that bandwagon before the robot catches us.
But this is, I mean, it's like the Twitter thing now, where Twitter will censor certain words unless you're verified, but won't censor certain other words. So somebody can be very rude to you, and then you get crossed back, and then you're blocked for 12 hours.
Right. Yep. And sometimes that works effectively, and sometimes it goes rogue. I guess you never really know what you're going to get when the robots take over. Let's see here. I know that there's more, but it's probably not in the Google section here. We talked about the Amazon. What am I missing? Anything jump out? Well, I guess Facebook has some interesting stuff along these lines, and actually very very timely right now. There's obviously some pretty crazy stuff happening in London with the high rise that was on fire, and yeah, it's just really devastating news. Facebook has its safety check feature that it's implemented a while back that's basically all around kind of alerting other Facebook users whether someone is okay or not. And they're basically pushing out a number of new features to this. One of them ties into fundraising. So essentially, I guess Facebook already kind of has a fundraising a program integrated into its service. So this is kind of tying it into Safety Check. So if Safety Check is activated for someone, this would allow someone to essentially kick off a nonprofit or a personal fundraising effort that might help around a scenario like this. Thankfully, all of those efforts are vetted by Facebook's humans, essentially, prior to that actually happening. But yeah, I mean, that's got to be a good thing in the case of a tragedy or a disaster of some sort. We're seeing safety check happen more and more. TechCrunch had an article that's really timely about kind of today's news or yesterday's news, wondering if safety check does more harm than good. And I think it's kind of an interesting question because I hadn't really considered it. I figured, you know, it's a network that has contact with a whole lot of people. So it would make sense that they would know whether someone might be in harm's way or not, would, you know, be there to alert their loved ones or their friends, whether they're okay or not. That seems like a great thing. The article in TechCrunch is kind of asking the question, like, does it cause undue panic and undue worry, depending on how wide of a net it casts based on who it's targeting for safety check or not? I don't know if either of you had a chance to take a look at this, because it's a little bit of a dense read, but it's an interesting question.
Well, I do recognize the problem, because we had that with both the terrorist attack in London and this fire thing, where basically it's asking, you know, a large proportion of the population of London whether they're involved in this. Whereas, and those were both scary things, but the number of people involved in each was, you know, a few hundred at most. But it's asking, you know, 5 million people to check in and give safety check responses, which is a bit bizarre.
Well, yeah, that's the challenge of a densely populated area like a major city like London, where, you know, it's a combination of where the app picking up where you are from your location as well as where you tell it you are. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, and then like the times I've seen a safety check in action have been like during a lot of the tornadoes in the Midwest and things like that, where people kind of mark themselves as okay. Those are kind of cast a wider net. And it's more, there's more wondering if somebody in Kansas is going to get hit by this tornado or not than this localized terrorist attack that happened on it within a couple of blocks radius in London. I don't know.
So, I mean, it is tricky because, you know, if it happens somewhere in central London, the terrorist attack on Tower Bridge and Borough Market, that is an area that I've been to lots of times. Lots of people have been to. My son's at work near there. So there's some reason was that they could have been in the neighborhood. But the idea that, you know, I was still seeing people marking themselves safe 2 days later and things, which was kind of weird. Huh. So it felt like they'd got the focus wrong. And the other half is when the disaster does happen, then everyone who knows you will check in anyway. And we were living in California, whenever there was a mudslide or a fire, our relatives would say, "You okay?" And we're like, "Yeah, that's 200 miles away that way." So there is that sort of it's behaving more like your sort of geographically confused relatives than Facebook. You know, Facebook is tracking where you are all the time if you're running the app or Messenger. So it could do a much more focused job of saying, "Okay, this person was very close to that neighborhood." Or was close to that neighborhood at some point in the last 2 days, and do a better job than it does. What I've seems to do is prompt anyone within, you know, a mile radius or 2 mile radius, which in London is a million people literally.
Right. Yeah. I mean, one of the examples from this article was that, you know, it's 120 flats in this London high rise that were on fire. People as far away as 8 miles were being prompted to check in. And what kind of a signal does that send to the people on the other end that see this check-in, you know, where they might not have been worried or concerned? Now suddenly they feel like there's a need to be worried or concerned, and it just kind of potentially spreads this kind of, I don't know, a feeling of panic where maybe it didn't need to be.
Right.
At the same time, like I'm conflicted because I'm like, yeah, but it's nice to use data that you have, information that you have, to do some to attempt to do some greater good. Maybe it's just not being used as efficiently or as effectively as it should be for this tool.
Well, I think the expansion of safety check, you know, in terms of with fundraising is interesting, because I know that you know, fundraising, I saw an article recently something crazy about GoFundMe, how the majority of like 80% of GoFundMe, more than half of GoFundMe's money that's raised through crowdfunding goes towards medical expenses. Right. And so this idea of crowdfunding in need and around disasters and around when things happen and things like that, that's, you know, like, clearly Facebook is doing that in order to help, you know, but also there's a business there, you know. So I think that's interesting as well, too, looking at what other functionality they can build on around Safety Check, as flawed as it might be.
Yeah. Yeah. I hadn't heard that news about GoFundMe. Medical campaigns make up $930 million of the $2 billion raised on GoFundMe.
Yep. Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
That says
more about healthcare than about Safety Check. So.
Well, the power of crowdfunding, I mean, you know, which is, and that ties exactly right into what Facebook had announced with their changes or with their updates to Safety Check, which is, in a time of need, sometimes, you know, personal fundraising is necessary, let's say. Yeah. And so they're including that into here. The TechCrunch article was definitely an interesting read. I just hadn't thought of it that way before. I've been like, well, this is obviously a good thing, right? Like, tell people whether you're safe or not. But if it's used too widely, it can almost work in the opposite direction. So apparently they have some work to do there to kind of tighten it up a little bit.
Yeah.
And then let's see here. What other crazy things is Facebook doing? Meanwhile, I wouldn't know. I haven't been on Facebook since December. Just throw that out there. Facebook wants you to type with your brain. This isn't weird at all. They have first announced this at F8 in April, that neuroscientists and engineers apparently are a little doubtful that Facebook could pull this off, but Facebook is investing millions of dollars in research anyways into the idea that we could someday share our thoughts to Facebook. I'm guessing it's part of the greater effort within Building 8, which is the incubator for moonshots at Facebook, that, if you remember, Regina Duggan once ATAP at Google has shifted over to. This is one of her, I'm assuming, many projects that they're working on, moonshots. To get us wearing a headband and transferring our thoughts into Facebook, that doesn't have any potential, you know, scary consequences whatsoever that I could possibly think of.
Wasn't this a moonshot pitch in Silicon Valley when Big Head was working at Hooli? It was like, yeah, wouldn't it be cool if whatever you thought just typed? And they're like, oh, can we do that? He's like, I don't know, maybe.
That's what the moonshot department is about. If you think it, yep, we can throw money at it. One question I had about this when I was reading through it is, are our thoughts structured like sentences? You know what I mean? Like, if it could read my thoughts, is it really like I'm thinking about something? It'd be like, I was thinking about whatever, like... I don't know. Like, you probably have to learn how to type like this.
Well, I suspect it's more like, you know, the suggestions you already get in Allo or Gmail or whatever else is making up little replies for you, and it'll just pick one of those from its bucket of pseudo human replies.
Yeah.
I think the more interesting thing is about this is Charlie Strauss, the sci-fi author, wrote about a while back, basically saying. 2007 is when the human species accidentally invented telepathy, because we're now communicating through Twitter and Facebook and all these, you know, disclosure induction social media with little things in our hands all the time. So basically all our thoughts are being sprayed out to the net and read to each other all over the time. And his argument on this is, and this was, he wrote this in January 2016, is that this is going to have really strange effects on politics. And I think that's that's about right. You know, if you look what's happened over the last 2 years in politics, yes, that is exactly what's been going on. There is this strange ability, you know, because we can actually communicate thoughts with each other and therefore ramp each other up into these loops of I have a wild idea, you have that wild idea too, let's all spread it out. And those spray themselves around social media and then spread into mainstream media and get taken up by political parties and all these things happen. The world has got very strange very fast.
And I had not thought of it like that before. My mind is slightly blown, because like when I think of telepathy, I think of it in the way, you know, of this article. But I mean, you're absolutely right. Like the barrier for passing along a thought, we it's just part of our daily nature, right? Like we have a thought, we act on that thought by pulling out our phone, punching out that thought into words and sending it out. And now everybody knows that thought. That's just the way that life is in this strange technological world that we live right now. It's not very far removed from just having thoughts be transcribed onto a screen automatically. It's almost right. The same thing.
Well, I think it's not far removed, but it's removed enough because if you've got because there's the filter there. There's the action of typing the letters and building the thought and doing it as opposed to the unfiltered kind of your thoughts being transcribed, because I'm feeling that if we could directly telepathically transcribe our thoughts and tweet them, the world would be much more disturbing than even as disturbing as it is now. And as much as we think that some people are doing that now by just saying immediately what they think and tweeting it,
yeah,
there's still a level of barrier that happens, and I would be even more scared to see what those people would tweet telepathically with no filter. Just imagine what they actually think. I love that they're investigating this as a moonshot. I love this as a concept. It's real sci-fi, but it's also like, you know, I hate handwriting because I've used computers for so much, and I'm now at the point now where my wrists get tired and I hate typing. And as much as I know a lot of writers who lean on like Dragon Dictate and other kind of voice, you know, speech recognition stuff, but to be able to just sit there and look at something and have your thoughts get transcribed into text would be like amazing, and would be able to make, you know, writing that much faster and easier, and just like imagine what it could unlock, you know, aside from just our unfiltered thoughts of, you know, for Twitter or whatnot, the productivity I think would increase of, could George R. R. Martin finally finish that Game of Thrones book if all he had to do was look at the computer and think about the story, right? That's pretty cool.
But that's part of the point. But the thing is, if you're a professional writer, or even if you're not these days, a lot of people are very fast at typing and have a very direct line between their hand and their keyboard, or their hand and their the touchpad, or or they use voice dictation and have trained themselves into a feedback loop with the computer to speak in a way that gets transcribed well. Whereas if you try and transcribe me talking at the pace I'm talking at the moment, Google falls over and then I have to go back and correct it. So I'm better off typing. Yeah. But whereas if you've taught yourself to speak at the pace that Google is happy with and space out the words a bit more, then it will transcribe it reasonably reliably. But the point is more that we have. It's not just about the gap between the hard problem is not the gap between your brain and getting into the computer, because we have four or five ways of doing that, all of which are pretty much close enough these days. But the weird thing that's changed is the ease of anyone being able to see that and spread that to other people. Mm-hmm. And that's the bit that feels more like telepathy, where you will see the news and you will think of a joke and go to tweet it and find that joke's already trending because everyone has had the same thought as well, which is the other sort of bizarre mirror part of this.
That's really true. I mean, yeah, that's another aspect. Yeah, I hadn't considered, right? Like it's super – and that's why you see a lot of this like reactionary – behavior on social media. It is so easy to see someone's thought and in a split second decide, I agree with that thought. Boom. Now everybody else knows that I agreed with it because I've spread it, and that network effect extends far and wide. And that's a direct tie right there. That's fascinating. More and more, I'm just not sure. I'm not sure about this newfangled technology, this social media stuff.
It's ruining everything.
Am I getting old? Is that what's happening? I'm getting old.
Get off my lawn, you kids.
Just let me draw my emoji. Dang it. We've got tips. We've got tricks. We've got numbers. I'm not sure what we have, actually, to be honest, after this break. But we're going to take a break. Yeah, it looks like we all have picks. Excellent. We're going to do the picks here in a second. Let's thank the sponsor of today's episode of This Week in Google, and that is Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. I don't know if you've done the mortgage process before, if you've ever bought a home or refinanced a home. It's not always that easy. It's not always that straightforward. The mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. And that's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgages to make your life a little bit easier. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or even refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple. It allows you to fully understand all of the details, because there can be a lot of details in the mortgage process, and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient, which is absolutely what you want. We live in the digital age, so we want more and more convenience. It's just part of how we do business online. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. So you don't have to go diving for, you know, information, paperwork, all that kind of stuff in the real world. They make it convenient for you and make it easy. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds, so you can be up to date. You can fit, you can kind of tweak your own scenario and find what's just right for you. It's based on your income, your assets, your credit. Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify, and then find the one that's just right for your scenario. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twig. That's rocketmortgage.com/twig, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030, and we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of This Week in Google. All right, all three of us have picks this time around. Kevin, why don't we go with your pick or picks? You might have a couple, I don't know.
Well, I have three related ones, so, IndieWeb is the group I help organize, and basically the goal is to get people to have their own websites again, and to find ways to connect between those websites, so you don't have to route everything through Twitter or Facebook, but you can have your practical telepathy on your own website too. There are a bunch of IndieWeb camp homebrew website clubs tonight. You probably missed already. The UK one has already finished. But we have Bellingham, Washington, San Francisco, and Fort Collins, Colorado tonight coming up at 5:30. So check the link there for those. The San Francisco one's at Mozilla. Bellingham's at the Foundry, and so on.
I think a friend of mine is involved in the San Francisco one, Kevin. I think my friend Tontek is involved in the IndieWeb stuff. Yeah, absolutely. I strongly recommend IndieWeb. It's awesome. So,
Tontek's a great friend of mine too, and he hosts it at Mozilla when he can, and it is there tonight. And so it's worth going down there, because and it starts at 5:30, quiet writing hour. 6:30, you hang out and talk about. You built your website. It's not quite Website Addicts Club, but it's like, I built my website and here's what I've done. I need help with this. Or have you thought of doing this? It's like a sort of self-help group for web building. And then the IndieWeb Summit is June 24th to 25th. So that's weekend after next in Portland, Oregon. And this is a full weekend. This is basically, you spend the weekend there. The Saturday is an unconference, so you get together and talk about things and have the conversations about different aspects of building your own website. And then the Sunday is a building day, where you get together and implement some of the things you've talked about or improve your site and so on. And that's coming up. Oh, and then there's a drinks on the Friday night. So that's coming up June the 24th, 25th in Portland, and there's still 9 or 10 places left, and it's going to be live streamed as well.
Nice,
cool.
And that should be, if they want to check on that, that's the indieweb.org or 2017.indieweb.org.
Yes, awesome. Indieweb.org is the main site. 2017.indieweb.org is the summit.
Awesome. There we go. So check that out if you're in the area. Great stuff. Ron, I recognize yours, but there was some news associated with this yesterday, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Some news broke a couple of weeks ago on All About Android. I brought to our App Arena a new email client called Astro, which is available for both the desktop as well as mobile. And if folks who have seen me on this show or on All About Android know that I'm obsessed with finding the perfect email client. And I don't know if Astro is the perfect email client, but I'm really enjoying it. It's got an AI chatbot kind of tied into it. That's their big kind of thing that they were promoting. The fact that you could like talk to this bot about your email and be like, who is Jason? And when did he write to me? And things like that. I don't necessarily use that, but it works with Gmail and with Office 360. And I believe that they're adding other support for other emails. Services. It's just a really well-designed, slick email application. But they were in the news, I think, yesterday or the day before with the announcement that they've added integration with Amazon Echo and Alexa, so you can interact with your email via your Echo. And I hope Google Home is coming soon because that's what I have. But then they also added a Slack integration, so you could actually interact with your email via Astro in Slack, which I find very funny because Slack is meant to be the anti-email. So bringing email into Slack is a bit of a, you know, like, yeah. But still.
Sometimes you got to do it.
Sometimes you got to do it. But it's a really, really well done integration. And it's really sleek and elegant. So if you're a Slack user and you're looking for an email client that integrates with Slack, Astro is the way to go. All in all, it's great. I'm moving into it to it for my desktop as well as my Android phone. So I recommend it. It's at helloastro.com. You can check it out there.
And do you integrate or do you I don't know, because you can chat with the AI bot from within the app. Do you interface like that at all?
No, I don't. I'm an adult.
I just
need my email. But no, I actually haven't played with the chatbot that much. Maybe I will a little more. I still need to load it in. Like currently, I've only got I have like 8 email accounts now that are actively going, and so I need a client that can do all 8 of them, and that takes a while to load them and organize and everything. So that's my weekend plan, is that I'm switching completely over after this weekend. Especially like I was testing it, I was playing with it with one email account, and it's passed the smoke test, and now that they have the Slack integration, I'm like, oh, I'm all in. So nice.
Awesome. All right, that's Astro, helloastro.com. Mine is just here to freak you out. It's Pix2Pix photo generator. This has been making the rounds the last couple of weeks. It's with an F, photogenerator.mpocloud.nl. This is one of those tools where on the left you have your input. I wish I could do it on my touchscreen on my Pixel, but it doesn't allow me to do it. But you can use your mouse. Essentially, what you do is you can clear that image and you can create a little a face. So I don't know, you could do something very rudimentary. Or you can get really detailed. Some people, I think, are able to, you know, use a Wacom kind of interface. I bet it would work really well on a Surface or whatever. And then you hit process, and it takes machine an AI algorithm on the back end that's been trained with human faces to take the face that you draw and it basically turned it into a human life form. It is the creepiest thing you'll ever see. And the more detailed you get with some of these pictures, the weirder results you get. I put a link to an article in the doc underneath this with just some examples of things that, you know, that artists have done and non-artists. And no matter how you do it, there's just a lot of really weird outcomes.
Jason, you love these kind of things.
I'm fascinated by it, and I don't know why. What I really love about this is I love the idea of taking what it was like a stick figure. Like, look at that. That looks like a beast or something. I love it.
It looks like Guillermo del Toro type monsters.
Totally. Right? Totally. Yeah, yeah. It's very much the, what was the Google, the Deep Dream stuff where, you know, suddenly, you know, you feed it a picture and suddenly there are eyeballs everywhere. But it's basically, it's doing this conversion from stick figure art or, you know, or just traced art of a face, and it actually turns it into a human. What would the human look like? And you can poke around and see some examples of what this thing has done. I mean, look at that. That's really cool. Like that stick figure, you know, that line tracing turned into an actual face with shading, and I've just seen some really crazy results, and it's just I wish I could come up with something half as awesome in my attempts to do this stuff. Mine don't like that dog. That looks really great. I don't know. It's a cool thing to scare yourself with, I guess.
Horrifying. Absolutely horrifying.
Horrifying, yes. But fun at the same time. Look for Pix2Pix photo generator, and you can play around with it and see what kind of horrifying art you come up with. It's just an interesting example of what AI is doing in this day and age. And we're at the beginning of it all, it seems. I think we did it. I think we made it. We channeled through the Google. We dug ourselves through the Android, and then we took a dip into the Facebook and Amazon waters a little bit as well. And it was a lot of fun because I had both you guys on. First, Kevin Marks, kevinmarks.com. It's always fun to get the chance to do this with you, Kevin. Thank you so much for staying up late with us. Uh-oh. I think your connection just went out. I'll say bye to Ron and I'll come back to you because I think it froze for a second. Okay. Ron, we podcast a lot, but it's never enough. Thank you for coming on to This Week in Google today.
My pleasure. Yeah, no, it was great. Great to be here to talk about more than just Android, talk about Google, Facebook, all that fun stuff. Yeah, thanks for having me. And folks can find me, follow me on Twitter at RonXO. And that's where I talk about all my other projects and other stuff. Check out my other podcasts, talking about comic books over at ifanboy.com and talking about Twin Peaks with Tom Merritt at damnfinepodcast.com.
Radical. And I mean, you're like deep in the current season of Twin Peaks, right, at this point?
Yes, we are one third of the way through the new season of Twin Peaks, Twin Peaks The Return on Showtime. And we put out new episodes every Sunday night, Monday morning, right after we watch it, we record and we do our immediate impressions. And it's been a lot of fun. And it's we got, I think, 12 more episodes to go. So all through the summer, it's going to be fun.
All right. Right on. You're doing a great job with that. And I'm sorry I missed you last night, but we'll be back there next week.
Yeah, of course. Everyone check out All About Android every Tuesday at 5:30 Pacific time here on Twit.
That's right. I'm stalling, of course, also because I'm hoping to get Kevin back. But I think Kevin might be lost to the wolves. I think what happened is Kevin saw my pick and couldn't help himself. And he got scared. He ran away. I'm assuming if we get him back, we'll say a proper goodbye. But I always enjoy podcasting with Kevin. It's great to have him on. kevinmarks.com if you want to find out about all that he's up to in the open web, which is very close to his heart, as you've heard on this show before. So a big thanks to Kevin for taking time out of his night to join us. And as for me, I'm Jason Howell. You can find me all over the Twit Network. Of course, I do Tech News Today every day with Megan Maroney, do All About Android with Ron, and a whole lot of other things on the network. And occasionally fill in here on This Week in Google. Reminder that Twig records every Wednesday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC. You can join live, of course, twit.tv/live. You can follow along live. We had some folks in studio watching for a while. That was a lot of fun. But you can do it virtually just by going there. And of course, you can find the show on demand at twit.tv/twig, T-W-I-G. And big thanks to John. Big thanks to Carson as well for helping out here in the studio and getting everything all coordinated with the show, because I always have a lot of fun doing it. So thanks for having me back. I think Leo's back next week, right? Yes, getting two big nods on that. So welcome back, Leo, next week on This Week in Google. We'll see you then. Bye, guys.